Hey David, thank you for coming in. You have a quite a remarkable history from a very young age, as a teenager actually, supporting transformational tech and solutions globally, and you've been working undercover in essence as well, and classified work together with public work and helping in sustainable impact globally. So just remarkable, and you're still a young person yet. So can you imagine what the next 50, or I guess it's unlimited now because I believe aging will be solved within the next few years. So can you imagine what lays ahead for you, David? So thank you for coming in and sharing your insights with our audience.
Well, humbling. One, thank you as well, Stephen, for both that incredibly gracious intro, but also everything that you do. I mean, what I admire is you both are able to speak to different groups that are looking for answers, and then actually put those answers into practice. And I feel like that's something that I really admire and something that's needed in the world we're in, which is, it's all too easy right now for people to sound the alarm and say, oh no, look what might be happening, or look at this trend, but not put forward what can we do about it. And I think what I celebrate is that you actually do yourself and the people that you bring together are really thinking about how we can be action oriented in a world that is rapidly changing.
So, David, you left the Atlantic Council, and so let's kind of continue that journey. I know you have your own consulting group, but you're so engaged in so many different other communities as well. Can you give us a nutshell, in a nutshell, just some of the different sort of stakeholders you're working with on a daily basis?
Sure. So right now I wear multiple hats, and probably I'll just pick three of them, even though there's probably more than three hats, which is one, you're right, I have my own consulting company, which allows me to work with both the private sector, but also I work with both NGOs, non-government organizations, and governments, really on how do we address how transformational technologies, emerging technologies, are impacting particularly how we either do business or how we do the necessary discourse required for civil living. And what I mean by that, I think, there's a lot of things happening. People most recently are looking at AI and chatbots, but we can also look what's happening with synthetic biology, commercial space and commercial space imagery. All of these raise questions about, one, how do you change your business models as a company and put it into practice? Again, getting to what I was sort of hinting at, which is it's not just enough to describe the trends. It's then actually, what are you going to do differently? What are you going to do about it? But similarly, it's also thinking about, what does this mean for open societies? How do we actually wrestle with this? The second hat that I wear is at the Simpson Center, where I'm a distinguished fellow. I'm also with Business Executives for National Security, where I'm honored they also think I'm a distinguished fellow there as well. And in both of those things, it really is sort of thinking through, as the same technologies and data advances are transforming the world, how do we think about how do we continue to do the business of safety and security, not just for, say, the United States, but for the world as a whole? How do we think about how, I just recently had an opportunity where NIH asked me to speak to their leadership about how they should be thinking about AI, chatbots, apps, and large language models for how they actually are going to provide health information to the public. And what I pointed out and they got, which is websites are increasingly not going to be the way that you're going to reach people. But you have to be aware of, if you don't get put out your own large language model, someone else will, and that might be wrong. And so how do you get ahead of the curve for disinformation? And then lastly, behind the scenes, I try to be a player in bringing different groups of people together. There's a group called the Global Vanguards, which we don't talk too much about, but it's really a network of people who care about dealing with things in a nonpartisan, non-attribution, non-absolutist way with regards to data and technology and helping behind the scenes. There's also the Loomis Council that I'm a co-chair for. And then there is hopefully going to be a space expert, where we're actually bringing together people that think about how space can actually bring public benefit beyond just commercial interest or government interest.
You'd be quite unique in that you sit across so many different communities. And so you have this very amazing 360 lens of what's happening in all these different areas from top leaders around the world, top scientists around the world, investors and CEOs. So you talked about some big buckets there. So synthetic biology in the space area. You also talked about generative AI and large language models. So sometimes they call these foundational models. So let's now delve into these things in more detail. So I believe then you're saying these are three sort of mega trends, and then it's going to have a outsized impact on all of us, not just governments, but business, even our families, really our children, our education, and really it'll impact every aspect of our lives. So first of all, what is synthetic biology?
Yes. So synthetic biology you can think of as, you know, if regular biology or normal biology is life as we know it, synthetic biology is life that we don't know it. And it may be, for example, taking bacteria that currently operates in a certain way and introducing into it the ability to possibly pull methane from either a air or liquid source, which we want to do because methane, unfortunately, is between 22 and 40 times as bad as carbon dioxide in terms of greenhouse gas, but use methane as a sugar source for the bacteria. And then while it's using it as a sugar source to produce the energy for the bacteria, then it's at the same time pulling nitrogen from the air, which there's an abundant amount, and returning it to the soil, which actually is good for the health of the soil. And so it is thinking about sort of how we can use sort of the building blocks of life. And I'm really thinking about, when I think about synthetic biology, I'm thinking about at the microbe level, to do functions that are helpful for either mitigating climate change, improving food security and food safety, or ultimately serving as ways that we can create a more resilient approach to what will probably be future outbreaks or pandemics.
So you're talking about synthetic biology, but it sounds like you're talking about carbon-based life. Are you looking at other kinds of possibilities of life forms that are not carbon-based?
That's out there. Carbon turns out to be really good as a building block for life. I mean, there's some that say, you know, will we get to silicon? There's also some people that look at, you know, just that's just really out there life. That is a part of synthetic biology. I think that's more on the research phase at the moment, and it's interesting to track. I think it's also you need to be very cautious. I get very concerned when I hear, for example, there are some people that are looking at, can they create the equivalent of neural circuitry that is simply neural circuitry that is not, quote unquote, a brain, but they're trying to figure out if they can do that. And so it gets ethically complex very fast. And I think one of the things that you have to be very cognizant of with synthetic biology is, you know, whereas if a computer system goes awry or does something you don't want it to do, you can either reboot it, pull the power plug, or hit it with an electromagnetic blast. We can't really reboot biology if we do it poorly. And so my own interest is really right now focusing more at the micro level and thinking about how we can solve some very practical challenges using carbon, admittedly. I'm more on the carbon side, but I'll give another example. We know, for example, that lithium mining is toxic to the planet. And with our move to EV electronic vehicles, there's going to be a huge more demand for lithium. And so DARPA and others are actually having competitions to see if folks can actually design bacteria that can actually mine lithium or at least deal with the waste products of lithium mining and other rare earth minerals in a way that's less toxic than the current processes. And so I'm a big believer that both through natural biology as well as synthetic biology, and there's actually another sort of in-between layer, which is called computational biology. So it's natural in nature, but it was sort of a computer helped organize how you would do the different sequences to produce that natural bacteria. So it sort of splits the line between synthetic and not. Those are going to be the ways that we deal with climate change, is using a combination of natural and synthetic biology.
So let's now move to this idea of foundational models, of which large language models are an example. So can you talk about what are these foundational models that are out there? What is a large language model? Like, how does it work? And you know, you may have heard, or you definitely have heard, Jeffrey Hinton left Google, and there's various opinions of why he did that. So that would factor into it. So that's good, very current news. So explain to me why these foundational models are important, how they work, and maybe give us a picture of what impact they're going to have and why.
Right. So large language models, they are, so if you can think of like a taxonomy, let's start with what artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence is an attempt to write computer programs that can learn and therefore show some degree of intelligent behavior. Underneath AI, then you have what's called machine learning, which is specifically machines that learn and they have feedback loops. Underneath machine learning, you then have neural nets. neural networks is sort of the idea that just like the human brain, that can change its wiring to deal with different stimuli and to deal with different consequences of behaviors that helps us learn, the machine is trying to do something analogous. And then underneath large language models, finally, you get to, underneath neural networks, you get to large language models, which is a subset of neural networks, subset of machine learning, which is a subset of AI. And large language models is really the idea that if you ingest enough text with a neural network and ask it to provide predictive responses to a prompt. And so you often hear with large language models, it's this idea of prompt or prompt engineering. It's a human asking something of the machine or typing a statement to the machine, and then the machine is responding. What the large language model is doing is it's attempting to do a predictive text response to the prompt it received. And it's worth knowing that, again, these have reached the point where they, you know, I think with the most recent, I want to say GPT-4, I could be wrong, but I think it was like 750 gigabytes of data was ingested, and that was mainly text data, obviously. That they have billions of different dimensions that are also tweaked by the modeling community, and there's iterations that go through it. And the net result is you now have a computer program that when you provide it a prompt, provides a response that looks human-like in the response. Now, it looks human-like based on the text and the data that it's been exposed to. And that's generally good. But also, you've seen some headlines recently where, you know, I think there was a journalist with the New York Times, I believe, who said that the machine, and when it was talking to the machine, somehow sort of said it was in love with him. Then it proceeded to prompt him to get divorced. And he's like, the machine is conscious. And it's like, no, the machine is not conscious at all. It is simply predictive text responses to what the journalist typed based on what the machine has seen. And I guarantee you somewhere on the web, there was a blog or some sort of post in which somebody said they love somebody and then they were encouraging them to get the divorce or something. And so in some respects, large language models are a reflection of us and the data that's trained on it. There is a phenomenon with large language models that people are working to try and minimize, which is called hallucinations, in which the machine will suddenly present something as if it was real when it's not. And it's, again, it's worth going back to how large language models work, which is it is predictive text responses to a prompt. At no point is the machine verifying something is real or not, or something is factual. At no point does the machine really have a understanding of how our solar system works, for example, but it is doing predictive responses that look like it does. And in fact, there's small examples where if you ask it to do math, generally large language models can't even do like simple math unless you help it through the process. And so hallucinations with a large language model is when it makes it look like something exists, like per the article in Nature 2022, volume whatever, the following paper exists. And it's the format of what looks like a Nature article. But then if you really try to search online for the article, it doesn't exist. That's just, again, the machine is trying to predict which will keep you engaged. And so when I talk to people, and right now I'm mainly talking to either people in the financial space or in the health and public health space, because these are two domains where disinformation could negatively impact a bank or impact a set of investors. And so how do they get ahead of it? But similarly, if they're not using it or if they're not aware of it, they could fall behind. And so they have to figure out, both in the health domain and the financial sector, how we can use these technologies. I caution them to, one, don't look to large language models to be a source of facts. However, it could be a way that you could engage your customers and then have additional mechanisms in place that try to do a double check or a triple check on the machine if it references something to see if that's consistent. There's also the last thing I would say real quick. We're seeing some people call for a pause. And you were mentioning the example of the person who most recently left Google. I suppose this is part of my internal frustration, which is I don't know if a pause is realistic. I give the example of in 1899, chemical munitions were perceived as a bad thing. People said these are dangerous, just like how some people are saying that this AI, these chatbots are dangerous. And so almost all the nations in Europe got together. They said, let's ban chemical weapons that are used as munitions. They said, sure. Everyone agreed. And a year later, all the countries of Europe that had agreed to ban them were covertly pursuing them as research objectives. And then come World War I, 1914, both the Allied and the Central Powers use chemical munitions against each other. And so I worry when people call for a pause, it's not really being pragmatic in the larger global context in which we operate, and that the only way through these challenges that now present themselves is actually to tackle them head on as messy hairball problems where we've got to involve businesses, we've got to involve policymakers, but also people who actually get stuff done in government and nonprofits to show a better way forward that empowers the public to be aware of what these are, what they can do, and how we're going to coexist with them. I don't think a pause is realistic.
Do you think then that these large language models are a predictive parrot, and so there isn't anything reasoning kind of ability in there? I'm not saying human, but some kind of reasoning capability.
So there is reasoning in the sense that, you know, what the large language models are probably doing is they are in the digital neural networks they are creating. They are establishing meta constructs for what a sun is, or what light from a sun means, or to do a following verb. And so they are creating meta constructs for ideas in language. And so there is a reasoning there, yes, and that can be useful in the right context. But again, if it's about truth verification, large language models by themselves will be insufficient. If it is about doing mathematics, much better way. Calculators are great. If it is about novel, new creation that is not simply just permeations on a theme, that's kind of hit or miss. You know, I mean, you see it, you know, there's talk about with generative AI where you see a lot of art that is generated off the art of others. And I think, you know, that is an interesting, it is an interesting question of is an art piece that a generative AI that has trained on millions and if not billions of images, is that truly a new creation? Or is it a lot like I equate in the music realm where you have digital sampling, where artists and recording artists do samplings of each other. They usually give credit. If they don't, they have a lawsuit. But by, you know, if you look at the digital samples that are reused, it can be a completely new piece in how it sounds and how it's mixed, but it still pays homage to the creators. And so I think as we try to figure out whether these are new creations or not, or if these are completely new activities, I think at least I would lean to the side of you still need to give credit and think about equity in the people who provided data that trained the machine, which gets to what I'm really privately championing at the moment and really a big component of. So we form a co-op where we have our data in some form, and we say, you know, we elect a group of three, five, I don't care, some number of people to serve as the board that represents our interest for that data. And then they are given the permission to represent us in conversations with the private sector, with governments that say, you can use this data. In this case, it could be health data on Parkinson's, but it could be something else. It could be our financial data or our local commute data to help inform policy makings for a city or a rural area. But we give you permission to use our data for the following purposes, as long as you're giving these benefits in return. And those benefits may be not monetary. They may be simply, we want to see an advancement of a cure for Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, or it may be monetary. But I think right now we learned a long wrong lessons in the last decade, which was data is to be hoarded. You know, there was the analogy of data is the new oil. I'm like, no, it's not the new oil. You know, oil, if you use it, it's gone. Data, if you use it, it's still there. And in fact, more use actually makes the data better because there's some metadata about it and you can actually refine it. So you want to use data. You want to figure out ways to deal with this non-fungible resource. And you don't necessarily want to hoard it because then it deprives the different stakeholders that could actually make it better from the benefits. And so that's why I think at the end of the day, large language models are the tip of the iceberg, but I think there will be other approaches we see that are both reasoning, and I hope along the way we also figure out better ways of sharing in the benefits collectively of these new tools.
Do you think that some in the community think there's more to that? And so when you advise, different communities like banks, financial institutions, you're saying it'll make a great customer service or sort of engagement tool, but nothing beyond that. It won't help an optimization of investments being made and things like that, let's say 2 years from now. You think there's just not that kind of capability?
I think it will help with optimization. I mean, that is a well-defined problem space. You know, there's some that say we're right on the cusp of AGI, you know, artificial general intelligence. I am very skeptical about that, and I'm welcome to be proven wrong. We're not, in my opinion. I mean, the other thing is also just this whole name. I mean, we really shouldn't be calling it artificial intelligence. I mean, we really should be calling it, in the case of large language models, natural generative language model. I mean, they are, you know, one, intelligence is a little bit difficult to measure, as we have discovered with humans. You know, you don't just measure intelligence using IQ tests. That is a very narrow and, in fact, very biased, in some cases, unjust way of measuring intelligence. But I think, you know, we need to recognize that they are only as good as the data they've trained upon. And if you expose them to a novel context in which they have no preparation thereof, they will fail miserably and they'll be brittle, which is not the case of a human being. We can be tossed in novel situations, and sure, we may not be perfect at doing it, but we don't have a complete failure. There's also, you need to be cognizant of overfitting, you know, and this is something that a lot of these models are dealing with, which is if they get overfitted, they can start giving what look like realistic answers when in fact they're completely wrong. And so I look at it at the end of the day, we really want to pair these generative systems, these approaches to mitigate or to address human weaknesses, but also recognize there will still be some things, especially in novel contexts. And if you're recommending to anyone right now that's in middle school or high school, pick a job in which each day is different and it's not the same thing, and you probably at least are going to future-proof your career a little bit longer than somebody else. But I get worried that there is all too often a human proclivity to anthropomorphize these machines and say they're cognizant and they're conscious and they're aware. And I'm like, they're advanced mathematics, yes. And they are reasoning at a level of language or language metadata, but I would not say they're cognizant or conscious. And I get very cautious when we do that, because it's sort of like how string theory in the 1980s said that we were going to have breakthroughs in just 10 years. And then in the 1990s, they said, give us 10 more years. And then 2000, they said, give us 10 more years. I think we will definitely see benefits from this, but I think there's also the risk of overhyping some of these advances.
Okay, so we talked about synthetic biology, and we talked about generative AI or AI and where it's going and so on, and sort of your viewpoints on that. You are also talking about space. So let's talk about where that's going and who are the players, where are the immediate near-term applications that you think are going to be quite profound for us and ways that will influence the broader community and not just niche areas and so on. And then, right. And what are the new opportunities?
So I think, you know, you asked about what's new with space. So I said, I think there's two tracks that have been happening. One is obviously SpaceX has been leading the way, although there are some competitors that are trying to enter into that market as well to bring down the cost of launch. So it's getting a lot cheaper to get things in orbit, which is good, because space can be very expensive. And if you just look at the cost to get things in orbit 15 or 20 years ago, it was a lot more prohibitive. That trend has led to the second trend, which is it's now a lot easier for commercial companies to do things that were only possible by large nation states 10 to 15 or 20 years ago. I mean, I think we had it in a previous conversation where I think I said this was 2020, which is the good news is we're democratizing technology. The bad news is, or challenging news is, we're democratizing technology. And so you're seeing, for example, 1 meter resolution, not just spectral imagery, but we're talking hyperspectral. So outside the normal visual range of things, you're seeing synthetic aperture radar at 1 meter resolution, or in some cases they're trying to do better if they're outside the US, which in some respects is very interesting to watch at what's happening right now in Ukraine and Russia with the battle space awareness, that there are commercial companies that actually are able to provide Ukraine better battle space awareness than they would through their own means if they wanted to. At the same time, one of the things that I try to help people think about is how is this going to be used in ways that we don't intend? I mean, are we going to see a court case 5 to 7 years from now where one aggrieved party says, you said you were going to the grocery store that evening, but I know based on satellite imagery, you went over here and you're really having an affair? Is that the type of world we want? And when I talk to my colleagues in Europe, I ask, does general data regulation, protection regulation, GDPR, does that apply to observations taken from space? And does that mean you have to ask consent before you take that photo? And what does that look like? And so, the good news is, I think in the next 3, 5, 7, 10 years, we're going to understand more about our planet than ever before. I don't know if we're ready for that, though, in some respects, because we're going to come face to face with humanity and both all the foibles. And so this has a tremendous upside to help in cases where there may be corrupt regimes or there may be things that aren't happening to be made more visible to the world. The question is whether or not the world will be overloaded with it so they can't pay attention, or will they figure out ways to pay attention to it. But also it raises interesting questions, because we know already there are hedge funds that look at the number of cars in parking lots to figure out if a retail store or retail chain is doing well or not. And they will either short that stock or buy that stock before their annual earnings call or their quarterly earnings call, based on what they're seeing from commercial space observations about the activities of that retail outlet. Let's fast forward to now with hyperspectral data from commercial sources. There is the ability to see stress plant lines. 400 nanometers is a stress line for plants that will actually indicate, before it's visible to you or I or any farmer, if that plant is possibly stressed and possibly near failing. Okay, well, what you would hope is we have a world in which this space data is made available to the farmer. It's maybe even made available to the local community to help the farmer if those crops are close to failing. That's the kind of world we'd want. But you could also imagine a world in which, unfortunately, that space data is not made available to the farmer. Only a privileged few use it to short that crop because they can see the stress that's happening, and they're worried about the whether they're going to make a profit off of hedging, whether or not that crop's going to succeed or not. That's not the world I think we want. And so one of the things that I think we need to be aware of is both who in a company is responsible for thinking about the company's proactive use of space data to improve the company's activities, but also safeguarding, or at least having a hedge of competitors using visual cues and other space-based gathered information about your company's activities, possibly to be a more successful competitor against you. And then finally, who is standing up for the public to say, how can the public benefit from understanding from space more about their communities, about their patterns of life, in a way that doesn't violate privacy, but helps inform our planet to be more resilient to future outbreaks, climate change, and also just general supply chain disruptions?
And in terms of your work, anything else you want to surface? Are you talking to NASA or some of the others?
I think what we're missing at the moment these are conversations I've been having with NASA while we have not gotten to the dream of we're living in space yet. The 60s and the 70s, there was aspirations, there was an image of at least some hope, even though we had plenty of problems here on the planet that we had to deal with, and we still have plenty of problems. And so I'm curious as to, can we create a non-dystopian narrative about the near-term future? Because I think right now, if you went, I have a 5-year-old, and for right now, he's a typical happy 5-year-old. But if you go to 15-year-olds, or even 25-year-olds, or even 35-year-olds, and ask them, what do you think 2030 is going to look like, or 2035 is going to look like? Unfortunately, most of them are fairly pessimistic, which I think is a huge loss, because it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy if you're pessimistic about the future. I'm not saying be Pollyannish. I'm not even saying be naive. I think hopefully I've been showing there is nuance to this. But optimists are the ones that make a positive difference. They are the ones that help change the world. And so one of the things I've been talking about with space is the very problems we have on here on Earth can actually galvanize action, and it may even create new markets. I gave a little bit earlier example with synthetic biology of how we could actually design a bacteria that could actually use methane as a sugar source, so that takes rid of that greenhouse gas and returns nitrogen to the soil. Well, part of the challenge we have is, what's the business case for that? And what if you actually use commercial space imagery that was hyperspectral to show, here is the problems you have where there's these methane leaks or these methane blooms that need to be addressed. That needs to be solved, because if we solve methane, that gives us a longer time to address carbon later. And then similarly, the same space-based data could show, and here's where your soil is lacking in nitrogen and lacking in the actual sort of healthy nutrients to grow suitable crops. And so if you surveyed that, you could then have a private sector entity come in and actually fix that problem by getting rid of the methane, returning nitrogen to the soil. And then again, commercial space data could verify, yay, verily, they did it. And so we actually have now created industry solutions to both climate and food challenges that actually, you know, help the future for us all. And so part of it is trying to stitch together using generative AI, using data, using commercial space technologies and bio, sort of the big challenges where we can begin to move up sort of the hierarchy of needs, because it's not like we're not going to have future challenges. We're always going to have future challenges. Hopefully there are new ones. But also at the same time, can we inspire a systemic approach, a science of systems that can tackle this, as opposed to one-offs, where I think we run the risk of, for every new crisis, we're having lessons incurred but not lessons learned. And even worse, the crises are becoming so fast that we're not even able to recover from the previous disruption before another crisis happens in the world. And I don't want that to happen, because that's not a good sign for anybody.
So are you working also with other space agencies, like the European Space Agency, maybe the Indian Space Agency, and so on?
I haven't had a chance to work with the Indian one. I have worked a little bit with Europe, and have worked with Japan. And so part of it is seeing where they're at and seeing what their solutions are. And also, but equally, I think increasingly space is a wonderful example, but so is biology and so is data and AI. Things that used to be done solely by governments increasingly can be done in the private sector as well. The challenge is, of course, private sector has to figure out, beyond just return on investment, you know, how does it frame its business activities? Because of course they have to be responsive to they have to have fuel in the tanks for profits, but they also have to be responsible if they have shareholders that are shareholders as well, or stakeholders at a minimum. And so I think if we're going to get through the next decade, it's going to be figuring out how things that used to be solely the domain of government and private sector never saw a need to help tackle, increasingly the private sector figures out how it can be playing a role, if not a responsible role. And then similarly, how can we shift what our nonprofits that in the past have written about issues but not actually done anything about it, how can we shift to being more operationally oriented? I'll give an example at the Simpson Center, which actually was right before our conversation today, Stephen, which was they are using open source space imagery from satellites about North Korea to actually have a better insight as to what's going on there, which is good because we don't get a lot of input and communication coming out of that country. At the same time, and there's actually signs that there may be a famine going on. At the same time, if that country is aware that you're using open source space data, you need to start thinking about, are they showing only what you want to see? And are there ways you can detect for that? And so, yes, I'm talking to other countries and companies. The one other thing I would share for your listeners, you know, there's a lot of attention that has been done recently on our digital exhaust or the data exhaust of individuals. And the questions about, you know, can that be monetized? Do you have consent? What does informed consent look like when you get a 40-page term and conditions? Most people don't read it. There hasn't been a lot of talk about commercial data and what we may be unintentionally or accidentally giving off. And so one of the papers that I recently did right before I left the Atlantic Council was the last one, actually. I worked with several other co-authors where we tackled a problem where we looked at 12 US military bases, and we picked them not because they were military bases, but because they were closed ecosystems. And we didn't look at the bases themselves, but we looked at the commercial patterns of activity around them. And we wanted to see if we could, without any supervised learning, so no generative AI, no training, if we could actually use big data methods to essentially detect a disruption to the military base. And the disruption could be anything from a change in commander. Maybe there was a fire that day they had to put out. Maybe there was flooding, or maybe there was a suspicious package or something like that. And so for these 12 bases, looking at just the commercial data around the base, not the base itself, we could detect to the day, in some cases the hour, a disruption. And so that's when I say in the next decade, we're going to realize we're going to learn more about our planet than we ever wanted to. I'm not sure we're ready for it. Thinking about future outbreaks or thinking about climate change, what can commercial supply chains, without revealing any trade secrets or revealing any intellectual property of the people, can we make our supply chains both more real-time and resilient, while at the same time producing a public good for the world, which is just better awareness of the disruptions that might impact our world to get ahead of the curve? In a past life, I did bioterrorism preparedness and response, and in 2003, after severe acute respiratory syndrome had played itself out, there were several big U.S. companies that said they would be willing to pay to prevent a second SARS. Of course, the U.S. government cannot take money or give that type of guarantee, but maybe there's a role for nonprofits and for-profits to actually better understand our planet through having instrumented supply chains that are less brittle, and at the same time informing how the world is changing and how we're changing it.
You know, earlier we talked about space, and then, you know, we vectored off in sort of areas that are related to space. What is the regulatory sort of environment like for space?
It's all things, and same thing, I think, for all these areas, the regulatory environment is evolving and in some cases behind. It's hard. So for space, it varies. Right now, it is still very nation specific. And so you have to get in the United States, you get a federal communications license for what you're communicating. If you're doing remote sensing or imaging, you have to get a NOAA license, a National Oceanographic Atmospheric Administration license. And then if you're launching or putting something up there, it's an FAA license. So it's not a one-stop shop. And that process can take time. It can be expensive. So I think in this age in which we may have a pacing problem, where the pace of change exceeds the ability for safeguards to keep up, what I would love to see is a combination of some general safeguards or streamlining of the process. But again, this is why I believe, I'm a big believer, and that's why I'm at Stimson, operational nonprofits that can sort of shoulder some of the risk that, you know, right now government is very risk averse, because if something goes wrong, it shows up on television, it shows up on social media. It may even be it worked well, but it was taken out of context for whatever reason. And curiously, despite what private sector says about their bold or risk-taking, especially public companies, they have to be risk-averse as well. They've got to think about, having things taken out of context. And so if the only way to gather expertise in this new era is to do experiments, because both experiments and expertise have the Greek word experia, meaning out of danger, if the only way we are going to get good at this is to do dangerous things that might not work on the first attempt, maybe the way to solve it, if both government and the private sector unfortunately can't take the big risks they used to take, it could actually be operational nonprofits that actually bring them all together in a safe space to wrestle with it. And I'll give one example and one past example, one future example, which is Project Corona in 1959 was a project to launch a rocket that would take photos of the Earth and parachute a film canister back to Earth. Project Corona in 1959, 1960, the first 13 rockets blew up. It wasn't until attempt number 21 they finally succeeded. But even Elon Musk has said after rocket explosion number 4 or 5, if they happen in a row, he's out of a job with SpaceX. Similarly, you can imagine, if this happened in the United States, how many people would be before Congress and cancel that program. Project Corona ultimately was successful. It was declassified in the 1990s, bought by a company that was then bought by Google and became the basis for Google Earth and Google Maps. And so, here was something that had dividends for decades as a result of being willing to do those hard things that didn't initially work, which leads to what I try to tell people, which is FAIL's an acronym. They just didn't tell you that, which is first attempt at iterative learning. And so whether you're a for-profit, whether you're a government entity, whether you're a nonprofit, plan your iterations so that you can manage the risk, but recognize very rarely on things that move the needle, it's not going to be done on the first or second or third attempt. And so you may have to figure out a way to sort of to accept the fact that we're all learning by doing as we adapt in this era moving forward.
You talked about some of the licensing required if you're a U.S. Headquartered entity. And yet, satellites are flying over different countries around the world on different continents. And, what does that mean? And will other countries put up some kind of policies that will impact? And so you got to get cross border licensing agreements or something like that. Do you see
it? Yeah, so it's the ITU. I mean, ITU is supposed to be the place that reconciles this. poor ITU. It's hard. And they're supposed to, so it dates back to, so we treat space like we do the oceans. And the reason why you have to have a license tied to a nation is just like in the oceans, you had to have a ship that's flagged coming from Norway, Canada, Sweden, whatever. Now, technically, when the orbits are approved, they come with constraints that are given to you by the nation state. Now, ITU can then say, we talk to country X and they have other requirements. We know, for example, there are commercial satellites that fly over certain countries that jam them. There's also cases when commercial satellites have been threatened to be shot down by certain entities as well. And that raises the question, when is a commercial satellite fair game to be shot down by a nation state? And the trouble is, of course, the debris field, and maybe they're not going to shoot it down. Maybe they're just going to disable it, but that could create a debris field if it collides. And then I'll throw out one last thing. You talked about, what does it mean that you still license things to nations? What if you put a satellite in orbit that was licensed to a nation, but it's got a 3D printer and it prints the satellite in space? Or as I often tell my financial and banking clients that I work with, if you handle a financial transaction in space, whose country's tax ramifications is that financial transaction reported to? And these are hard problems that don't have any easy answers. And it's only going to get harder when we start putting data centers on the moon and who knows what else. But these are things that if you're really thinking about the future as a company and how you can, I tell people it's much better to disrupt yourself than have someone else disrupt you. So if you're really thinking about how you can disrupt your own company to be ahead of the curve, these are questions that you can then sort of drill down to actual use cases and have an approach that says, here's what we're going to do because the market is changing, and to expect that someone else is going to solve it is probably waiting too late. We will be disrupted if we wait for someone else to solve it.
So you talked about some of the agencies that you are directly engaged in, and you talked about the ITU. Are there others that you're talking to as well, and from an international standpoint?
So at the international level, there are times when I touch base with the UN. In fact, I've been helping some with their thinking about what they can do with other countries involving data and thinking about data and commercial activities. And in Africa, I actually did a project with another colleague, Eric Sapp. I find right now, a lot of my engagements, it's usually at the request, the nation state still holds sway. So it's either at the request of a national government, or it is at the request of a transnational that is interested in a specific region. I think the challenge you have for international agencies, at the end of the day, we still have a rule of law, we still have sovereignty. And so international agencies are kind of trying to get people to work together, but it's hard. That said, I won't reveal the name. Well, I have had conversations with nations that are at the level of city states, is probably the best way to put it. And I won't name any specific ones, but you can guess there's some out there that have said, we look at the world and it's hard for us as a nation state, city state, to be able to influence what's going on. And one of the things I actually put out there, I said, well, what if you form an alliance of cities around the world? We've already seen cases, including here in the United States, as big as we are, where New York and San Francisco and some other cities have entered into trade agreements directly with other countries, bypassing our own federal government, which I'm waiting to see if there's ever a response on. But it does point to that as more and more people move to cities, I'm not saying forget the rural areas. In fact, the rural areas are essential and we have to figure out a strategy for them as well. But could it be that a union of united cities in some respects could be a positive force, partly because mayors have a more accountability to the immediate for their people? And so it could also, you could think about how we have in Estonia, where you can become an e-resident of Estonia without living there. What if you had a sort of an e-residency program for this network of cities, which allowed you to work in any of the cities, have faster access, do stuff in those cities? I think what technology is doing is it's meaning that you need to pivot away from nations to networks, but we're not there yet.
So can you go a little bit more macro to that? So in the US, go to county level and then state level, and same kind of divisions around the world. So more regional rather than city.
It could be regional, but I think it could also be by interest or ideology. As I tell people, I say, when I talk to audiences, I say, raise your hand if you know more people in your neighborhood than you do online. And most people don't know more people in their neighborhood than they do online. It's like, okay, so we changed that. Raise your hand if you intentionally every day seek out news that challenges your beliefs. And some people do, depending on the audiences, but most people don't. Okay, so we live in echo chambers of news. We know more people online than we do in our local neighborhood. In some respects, is it about physical proximity or is it about shared mutual interest that may differ in terms of you may be approaching it because you're caring about this as your business entity. I may be a completely different sector, but I have the similar interests as we go about doing it. I think what we will look back to in 2035 is that this was a period in which we went from organizing by geographical and regional proximity to networks. We may still be reminded sometimes it matters in terms of environmental footprint and things like that as well. But what I want to make sure is that we don't become networks of diametrically opposed opinions. I was in Hungary. I was in Poland. This was before COVID, but there are cases there where I met with people and they said, we're from different groups. The only reason why we're talking together right now is because you're here. But once you leave, we're going to go back to, you know, we're going to be on one side of the aisle and the other side of the aisle. And I'm like, that's not a good thing for the world. But I think, you know, my recommendation for any business or government or city, find ways you can build networks of shared interest, because that way it's not just you motivating a change. It's your alliance of other networked people doing the same.
And then you see something like the internet as a means of that kind of engagement. And then maybe things like the World Economic Forum or other groups out there as a forum where you can get some physical presence to those self-organizing groups. Is that how you see it?
I see the internet is helping. World Economic could be a role. I think it's got to be, again, I would love to see those networks. The thing with the World Economic Forum is really good about convening. What I would like to see is more, okay, now we're going to create this nonprofit or this startup or whatever, which is focused specifically on this initiative that can help carry the ball forward. And so let's say we all get around the idea of, we learned in COVID that supply chains are brittle. A disruption to supply chains impacts us all. And so we want to create an initiative where we can pool data that doesn't reveal any intellectual properties or trade secrets, but allows us to create less brittle supply chains. And so there's this network alliance of shared companies and or cities that care about this in the world. And then the operational component to make it happen is this nonprofit that can bring in for-profits, and maybe even the for-profits, if it's successful, can run away with the model and be profitable with it. But it's the safe space to show that we can tackle this hard problem, incubate it, and then actually achieve the end, because the network by itself is not going to actually do the executive work or the execution work required to make it happen. But they can then give legitimacy to whatever that organization is, for profit or nonprofit, to move the ball forward in doing the experiments to solve the problem.
You know, there's a lot of heavy lifting there, though.
Oh, yeah. And that's what I like to do. I mean, I often look back at my life and my loving wife says, yeah, you tend to pick the hard problems because those are the ones that really are the ones that are most meaningful to tackle with. So it is a lot of heavy lifting. But I think that's, and I also worry, if you go back to the late 1800s and early 1900s, right before World War I, there was tremendous technological change. There was industrialization. And with the printing press, with the news and mass media, the news, with the telegram, there was also disinformation. So it seems like whenever we have a new technology invention, be it radio, be it television, mass print, I mean, this is how Pulitzer and Hearst made their money initially. There's disinformation. There's also polarization that was present in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And there was also, I sometimes say we're in the neo-Victorian era. With this disinformation and with this polarization that was brought about by this new technology, there was also a whole lot of signaling that wasn't actually doing. And I worry that you know, there's a lot of doing going on in the world, but it doesn't get anywhere near amount the airtime that a lot of signaling or problem admiring occurs in the world. And so if there's any one recommendation I have to people, which is if you have the luxury or the perch to be able to speak to the press or speak to media, make sure you use the last 20% or somewhere in between, in 20% of that, to put forward actionable things we can do. You can always say, this is just my opinion. It may not be, you know, what we end up doing. I just worry right now we are surrounding, again, those 5-year-olds, 15-year-olds, 25-year-olds, 35-year-olds with, it's scary. or bad things are coming, and end. And it's like, no. I mean, you got to put forward, here's what we're going to try. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to learn. And it's creating a sense of learned helplessness in the world, or that's hard and I don't want to tackle it. You know, the policymakers will do it. And I'm sure the policymakers are like, we'll let the business handle it. And so if everybody says someone else is going to solve it, that's where we are.
So that's a natural segue into my final question. And give us 3 to 5 actionable areas.
I'm perfect.
And that's real, right? Where they can say, oh, okay, I can go there and I can do something.
Yeah. So first step would be, actionable steps I would do is look at the Mozilla Foundation. They're not the only one, but they're a good example. Do Mozilla Foundation and data collectives. Learn about data collectives, have a conversation with a friend or family member about data collectives. Talk about whether you think they're good or bad ideas. Just become aware of this idea that maybe we could do data differently. Because right now, I think a lot of people feel like their data is hoovered up, and so be it. And I'm like, that might be how the railroads used to be before we figured out ways to balance things. So that's the first thing. Second thing, see if you can begin to create a monthly gathering of your friends, but also people that you've met that have different views, to say, this is going to be a space in which we don't have to agree. It's a safe space, but let's talk about some topic and become comfortable and not taking things personally if someone has a different view than you, and create that environment. Because I feel like, again, and this may just be an unintentional consequence of social media, just like how radio and the news did the same thing in other revolutions. It's almost like we have decided to self-select from having difficult conversations about things that matter. And I think, you know, whether that's soundbite culture or whatever, it's hurting us because these issues are important. And the reality is probably none of us have all the answers, but collectively we can have a better answer if we share our different viewpoints. And so that would be a small thing, but just to sort of create a convening space. A third thing I would recommend that people can do, if you're passionate, figure out something you're passionate about and try to write an op-ed. You know, unfortunately, op-ed spaces in the main publications have gotten crowded. But, you know, if you take the time to research something to write about it, that may then lead you on a journey of then taking the next step, which is actually doing something about it or things like that. But take the time to sort of write a nuanced sort of article that you're passionate about and put that out there. Because there's, you know, the good news is there's more than 8 billion people in the world. That should be enough to handle some of the problems that we're tackling. But again, it's overcoming this reluctance of learned helplessness. The last two things I would say, I mean, obviously, Stephen, you're a great example of this. Give voice to others. You know, I try to figure out who are people that are not being heard that I can help amplify. Can I create a space for them? Can I give them a chance to sort of be heard? You know, all of us, I think, have a responsibility to try and figure out what to do with this, but give a voice to someone that's not being heard, that's not yourself, and see if they can actually have that opportunity and run with it. And then the fifth thing, when you're listening to something on the news and all of a sudden your emotions kick in, you're either angry, you're fearful, you're anxious or something like that, take a deep breath and say, why are my emotions up? And then two, trying to go up to the balcony. At the Kennedy School, they talk about, you know, oftentimes we're hearing in the news these dance moves, and we think the dance floor is crowded or someone's not doing something they shouldn't do. But we rarely go up to the balcony and say, well, what's really happening here? And so if we can take that time, then we can begin to both practice when rage-tainment or news gets our blood vessels pumping, but we can also begin to practice ourselves that mindfulness of saying, well, what's the really big thing happening here? And maybe if we all start to do that, it's been shown actually, if you have more nuanced conversation, then that begins to have other people have more nuanced conversations. And maybe eventually those in charge or those policymakers we elect or put in positions will also be able to have more nuanced conversations, because the world has feedback loops. And anyone who tells you it's simple or it's just a black and white issue is probably oversimplifying it.
Well, those are good words of wisdom. And actually, you practice all of them as well.
Right. Well, you put me on the spot, but I wanted to rise to the occasion. So.
Well, yeah, David, that's it. That's it. I really thank you for coming in and sharing all of your insights with our audience. And I really recommend the audience also follow your work, because you're out there. You you're in social media, but you publish, you do all the things that you talk about. So, and you're always giving, you know, insights that people can action as well. So thank you again for sharing so much with us.
Well, thank you, Stephen, as always, and thanks for everything you do as well.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.